We've recently been going around the country and around the coast to talk to fishermen about their lives and the challenges presented by their work. Noel Sweeney has been out on the pier in Howth in County Dublin, and this week he met the owners of trawlers and inshore vessels to talk about their life at sea, quotas and the potential effects of Brexit.
Today I'm meeting with fishermen from Howth who are telling me all about Brexit, life at sea and how they do their work. My first meeting was with prawn fisherman Richard Brennigan. He's the owner of a trawler. And he started by telling me about life fishing out in the Porcupine.
We'd have six of a crew, and well, seven including myself, and it takes about 18 hours to steam into it. And what would it be? Yeah, there'd be a lot of foreign, Spanish and French out there as well.
What's it like competing with our neighbours?
It can be hard. It can be hard. Yeah, there's times out there they wouldn't give you an inch. And it's, as I see it, our waters, and they've more rights to it than we have. They've more quota than what we have. There's one boat, French vessel has more monk quota than the entire Irish fleet. Just one boat.
So what's that like, dealing with that, or coping with that, or just knowing that?
It's a hard pill to swallow. So it is. At this time of the year, the weather's really, really, really bad, and with the quotas that's in place, it's an 8-ton quota, and this month so far, with the way the weather has been, the chance of getting the 8-ton is impossible. And because we didn't get out there now this month, that 8-ton is gone.
Any way of making that up?
No, it's gone.
Why not?
It's just the way the rules are imposed on us, that once you don't use it, it's gone. It's hard, and it seems to be just getting harder every year. It's just getting harder and harder and harder.
So what keeps you interested?
I suppose the love of the job, but that's getting less and less. Well, the prawns we catch, we freeze them at sea, and then we export them out straight out to Italy.
What's the Irish market like?
It's very bad at the minute. Even the prawn market itself is very bad at the minute. With the prices and everything else, they're really poor there at the minute. With the quotas being so bad for fish, that a lot of the bigger boats have now turned to prawn fishing, which is worse for us because there's more of a supply. But with them, they have to turn to something. If they can't go with fish, they have to go with prawns.
What are your main challenges at present?
The challenges, I suppose, well, the weather this month. Crew would be a big one. It can be hard there to get a crew there sometimes. There'd be no Irish fellas there wanting to do the job, really. Well, very little of them. It's mostly a foreign crew we'd have.
How do the quotas affect your business?
Quotas are the biggest part of it. But the quota there we have for the Porcupine Bank, as I said, we'd 8-ton there for this month. There's no chance of us getting that 8-ton. Whereas if we're registered in the north, that quota could be carried over or could be sold to another vessel. We're not allowed to do that down here. If we don't catch it, we can't carry it over to the next month, and it's detrimental.
Were you affected by the new law that disallows large trawlers to fish inside the six?
Big time, yeah. Where we always fished, and I fished with my father on the east coast there out of the Skerries, and where we fished there for years and years and years down to the bay there, we'd call it the bay, and we can't go in there anymore. Whereas, as I say, we've been fishing there years, and it's like someone just said, and that's it, you're out.
I suppose they'll argue about the benefits to marine life and the sort of smaller fishing fleet.
Well, yeah, but it's pushing us further and further and further. And the likes of us going to the Porcupine, the boat we have probably would be, it's just borderline big enough to go out there, but the weather that does be out there and everything else, you really are pushing the limits.
What does it take to run a vessel of that size?
You're talking about running costs for 24 hours is up and around about €1,600 a day. To be making any money, you have to be at a minimum of €3,000 a day, and that's hard at times.
It's in the ether, Brexit.
Yeah, if it does come as bad as it can, 65% of our fishing is done in English waters. And if we're put out of there, and not alone if the other EU, French, the French and the Spanish are put out, they're just going to come over, more vessels over here, more pressure on us, and we won't be able to fish in English waters then either, which 65% of our gross and gone.
What would you like to see happen?
Better quotas. Best outcome for us probably would be if things stayed the same and we were allowed to fish away in the Celtic Sea and that, as we have done for years.
Alan Fanning is an inshore fisherman specialising in crab and whelk. He told me about taking on the family business from his father, and I learned a little bit about whelk fishing.
I'm fourth or fifth generation fisherman. As I said, we're originally from Loch Shinny. We moved up here 9 years ago. We fish out at Hout Loch Shinny Harbour. It's tidal and bad storms and stuff. You're running around trying to mind it. So we moved up here and it's been going grand, you know. So
you mentioned being fourth, fifth generation fisherman. What kind of changes have you observed since you were even a child, or, you know, anecdotally handed down from generation to generation? What have you noticed? What have you seen? What have you felt?
Yeah, well, I started fishing with my grandfather on my school holidays at 12 and 13, and it was in an open, an old Irish Lights tender down off Loch Shinny. We only fished 50 pots, so we were fishing lobsters and just lobsters for the fish market in Smithfield there. And you know, you get your few bob every Saturday when my grandfather would come home. You thought you were a millionaire. Like, it was brilliant. It was great times. And I progressed from there. Then when I finished school, my father wouldn't let me leave school till I had my leaving cert and all done. So when that was done, then I went to fish with my dad. So we fished with him for the next 4 or 5 years on and off, and then I bought my first boat and basically took over the business from there. So we 27 years to get to this boat that we're on here now. So of hard work, and you know, my dad is on the pier there at the moment mending pots as we speak. So he's 72 now, and he's a fabulous fit man for his age, and the next generation coming up are nowhere near like him, so unfortunately. So time will tell how that goes, but you know, I remember not seeing him for weeks at a time. Like, he was gone, he was fishing, and he told me stories about good times fishing and stuff, you know.
Alan then showed me a purpose-built machine specially designed to separate out his stock.
See, you have a nice purpose-built device out there for it. Can you talk me through the process of whelk fishing and tell me where it goes and how it's processed and all that kind of stuff?
Whelk is like a sea snail, so if you're walking on the beach, like, you find an empty shell, that's usually a whelk shell or a hermit crab shell. So basically, we haul the pots in over the gunwale here. So anyway, the whelks get divided up in this machine. We tip the pots into the trough here, and we the whelk goes down through it. It's washed as it's going down through, and we separate the small stuff falls out the first slots, the mediums fall out the second slots, and then the large goes out the back. So every string we could be releasing 15 to 20 kilos of undersized whelks, every string that goes back into the sea alive, so, and they get a chance to grow. So basically it's a thing we got purpose built. Myself and another fisherman in O'Leary got them done, and they're it's a great job, because before that, like, you know, you want to try and manage and look after your fishery, so it's very, very important to have it. And we sell the stuff then to Sophomar down in Wexford, and as far as I'm aware, the large stuff goes for the sushi market in Japan, and the medium stuff then is either cooked, backpacked or sliced, and it heads off to other European and continental markets. So that's basically the ins and outs of that.
Noel Sweeney speaking to Richard Brannigan and to Alan Fanning. We'll be returning to these issues over the next few weeks. Earlier this month, I was presenting the awards at the Irish Specimen Fish Committee Awards Ceremony. There I met many anglers who are very specialised in what they do. I spoke to a few of them that told me about how they target big fish.
Yeah, my name is Sydney Kennedy.
Sydney, you've got a whole lot of awards here at the Specimen Fish Committee.
Yeah, well, it's for the last 20-odd years we've been hunting for fish. Like, and over the last 7 or 8 years, the IFI, especially now with the specimen committee, have done great work between measurements and helping the fish species as well. Like,
what fish do you target?
Everything from sea to fresh. If it swims, I hunt it.
What's the obsession?
As you say yourself, it's just to get out. It's peace of mind and sport and good fighting fish. That's what you want.
You were involved in the lock in Cork. You have a particular issue about it.
Yeah, it's since 2 years ago when the whole population of the lock carp stocks died. What we're trying to do is organise meetings with the council to actually restock it. But more important is actually what we want to do is clean the lake up to make it more suitable for fish and, I suppose, potential people walking around the lake, to make the lake way better, because the water quality is way below EU standards. And as
you've measured that yourself.
Yeah, we've done that, and it's way below their criteria. And as we've been told, is that if it was actually tested correctly, there's actually fines issued, something like 10,000 a day fines through the EU regulation. So, like, we just have to have meetings just to sort things out in the long run rather than in the short term.
What's the best? You've got a whole lot of awards today. What's the best fish you've caught this year, last year?
I suppose, in my eyes, it would be this stingray of just over 50 pounds. That would be kind of top of the list. But I have, I suppose, a number of fish, smoothhound. Well, they're all good, to be honest. Any one of them will do.
Where'd you get the stingray, and how do you catch something like that?
Normally in the kind of springtime there in Finnish, down in Tralee. I think it's the only place roughly in Ireland where you can get them, and they kind of settle in there for maybe 2 months of the year, and then they move off. So they're hard to catch, but they're fun when you do, like.
And you actually heard Sydney's daughter Amy, who's 8, speaking on the programme last week. The next people I met were the Tully family.
My name is Liam. We have Kim and Zoe, my two daughters, and my grandson is there as well, David. Within the specimen awards, I had 3 specimens last year. Zoe had 2, Kim had 1, David had 1. We're lucky. We do a lot of fishing together as a family, and it's a nice way to spend a day out as a family on the water. Rivers, lakes, sea, you name it, we fish it all.
How did you get them? Your daughters and your sons interested in this?
My daughters have been fishing with me since about 5 years of age. As long as they were old enough to put a life jacket on, they've been in boats with me, and it's just a nice way to spend the day.
Because it's a sport, we were over at the angling show, they're trying to get women involved in a big way.
I think women make better anglers than men. I think they are more sensitive. They feel bites better. I fish with a lot of women, and I think they are better anglers.
Yeah. What specimens have you caught here today? And the specimen being a record fish for the year.
I had a smoothhound and 2 roach bream hybrids.
The smoothhound probably caught on in the Irish Sea somewhere.
It was.
And the roach bream.
Roach bream, we do a lot of lake fishing. We do, and we fish down in Mullingar. We pre-baited for a week. We put in over 1.5 tonnes of ground bait. And then an actual 1.5 tonnes of ground bait over 5 days.
Okay, so that's things like breadcrumbs, things like that?
Maize, ground meal, 2 gallons of maggots, about 50 cans of corn, you name it, we load it up.
So you pick the place you're going to go fishing? And is it a place that you would, same place you go every time, or different places?
It's a place we have fished for the last 20 years, 25, 30 years.
Yeah.
We get a lot of fish over it over the years. We got specimen tench, specimen bream, specimen hybrids. We've got a huge amount of really good fish out of it, and it's just... it's an outing. We do it every year. In January, the kids, we've already picked the date for fishing this year in June. My 2 daughters, one of the daughters has 2 children. The husband looks after the children. We go fishing. The bigger grandson comes with us, you know, and it's a family 5 days fishing.
Hi, my name's Kim Tully.
Kim, you got a specimen award here today for what?
So we had a roach bream hybrid.
What is a roach bream hybrid?
It's a hybrid of roach and a bream.
Freshwater fish?
Yeah.
You go fishing with your dad. What's the attraction of it?
It's kind of, we go down and we spend a few days camping, and the whole family come down and stuff. So it's partially the social aspect of the banter of it as well, really. So
yeah. You've been at it all your life?
Yeah, we were dragged along when we were little, so crab fishing down the harbour and stuff. So
did you ever rebel?
No, not at all.
Really?
Not at all.
it's a sport that we don't see too many women involved in for some reason or another.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess we're all quite sporty, like outdoorsy and stuff, like, so kind of normal to us. But yeah, there'll be a few far between now.
You'd recommend it?
Definitely, yeah, absolutely. We're all for the camping and the getting out.
How you doing, Fergal? Terry Jackson, part-time worker, full-time angler.
You have an extraordinary haul of certificates here today on specimens. What have you been fishing for in the last year?
Last year, basically trying to diversify a wee bit, because although I enjoy catching the same species every year, it's nice to catch something different that you haven't sort of ticked the box. So the last couple of years I've been trying for stingray, and I've caught a lot of stingray, but I just cannot get the 28.5-pounder.
So which would be a specimen.
It'll be a specimen, yeah. That's your kind of barrier to break for a specimen. But I'll keep trying. I'll be back again this year.
But you haven't got other certificates this year. What for?
This year, Smoothhound in Wicklow. We took a run down to Wicklow this year. Twite Shad in St Mullins on the Barrow. All of them I've caught before, but I haven't caught them in a while. So I haven't caught Smoothhound in about 5 years, so I thought we'd have a go at that.
How do you target a big fish or a specimen fish?
Well, the specimen fish committee has a lot to do with it, because you have the dates, you have the venues within reason.
Okay, so you have to do your
homework. And then what helped us a lot in Ireland was forming a network of specimen anglers. So I got to know Sid in Cork and other boys around Ireland. So if something's happening there and then, if you're able to drop everything and go, that's when you'll catch, you know. So you're relying on kind of local information around Ireland, and it's like a network, and straight away that kind of opened the doors to specimen hunting, and it took our specimens per year from like 5 or 6 up into the 20s.
Okay.
You know? But you have to have the ability to drop and run, basically, you know. Poor lads that have to work every day of the week, you know, that's where they're stuck, because fish aren't kind of like ruled by weekends. You have to go when they're feeding, and that's that.
There's no luck involved, essentially.
There's always luck involved. There's always luck involved, but I've done it. You'll catch the lucky big fish. But if you want to be consistently catching big fish, you've got to be in the right place, the right time, with the right gear, and be able to play and land it. And then that's where a bit of luck comes in.
When we talk about specimen fish here, one of the priorities is that all these animals are returned alive.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We've always, in the past where bodies of fish had to be produced, we haven't done it, because simply you just don't want to kill a fish. And most anglers are the same. They respect the life of the fish. They know how fragile the species are, the stocks. So it goes against the grain for most anglers to kill a fish. So it's great with this new sort of directive that they're doing with the length-based specimens, because it's a quick matter of putting it on the mat, photographing it and releasing it.
It's an IFI-approved mat.
Yeah, because in the old days, if you catch a species on a boat, for accurate weighing, it had to be brought ashore. So your boat had to carry barrels of water and air pumps and stuff like that. And we still do that to a certain extent, but to get away with the measurement is so much handier and so much better for the fish.
And you'll be able to get that Irish specimen fish book on the IFI website. Captain Brendan Ford spent 50 years at sea and has been around the world several times. He was on various merchant ships. He went to sea first in 1947. He recently came into studio and recorded a number of pieces for me. Here he talks about his favourite ship.
My favourite ship, the SS Dahomey Palm of Liverpool. I joined the Dahomey Palm at Liverpool in July 1950 as a junior ordinary seaman. My rate of pay was £12.10 a month. I was disappointed at the pay, having sailed under the Swedish flag at a higher rate, but I was anxious to get a ship, and the destination was everything that I, as a would-be explorer, could have wished for. West Africa. The deck sailors lived forward under the forecastle head, sharing cabins. The master and officers lived amidships by the bridge and over the engine space. Some catering staff also lived amidships, with engine room hands in the poop at the rear of the ship. All sailors except one were British or Irish, the officers being British, Captain J.F. Pugh, the first mate, J.K. Roberts, and the boatswain, Flapjack Johnson. The leading seaman was the only non-European in the forecastle, Stephen, or Stevens by name. He was an old-style sailor and admired by all for his professional skills. He was Jamaican and had been in the ship for several voyages. I was lucky to be teamed with him, working on splicing steel cables for our cargo handling gear. The carpenter lived a life that struck me at the time as being perfect. His cabin was neatly furnished. I can picture him now, seated inside, smoking his pipe, looking out through the ever-open door over the gleaming brass step, and his brass door title, Carpenter, forever newly polished. Mr. Roberts, the chief mate, struck me as a very kind gentleman. I was not in good health at this time, and he gave me some personal attention and kindness when I needed it. I kept a sketchbook in which I recorded scenes that impressed me. One of the best drawings I did was of the forecastle head of our ship. I spent a lot of time on it while on lookout duty during the night watches and at leisure time, especially after the canvas awnings were rigged in the tropics. Ashore, near Lagos, I sketched shipmates at ease in the billiard room of the Merchant Navy Club in Apapa. At Abonima, I sketched women with their headdresses and skirts of locally made cloth, which added to their grace and colour. We called at Freetown in Sierra Leone, taking on local crew boys to work cargo at various ports of call. They lived in tents rigged on top of the cargo hatches. The ritual issue of sun helmets and the daily issue of lime juice for vitamin C and paladrine to fight malaria appealed to my explorer imagination, but also reminded me that there were dangerous diseases about. We called at Dakar, Takoradi and Accra on the Gold Coast, Apapa near Lagos, Calabar, Victoria, Tico, Sapele, Abonima, Grand Bassam on the French Ivory Coast, and Bathurst in the Gambia. At Accra, we anchored offshore, working our cargo into surf boats. This was a most interesting spectacle, not least when the arriving surf boat, powered by men using paddles, tried to jump the queue, and pitched battles followed, using thick rope ends as weapons. Cargoes were landed on the beach in hazardous surf, loading 30-foot logs of hardwood from the water into our ship was just as dangerous, with the local men going into the water in big swells to pass the cables of our lifting gear around and under the logs. At any moment it seemed that they would be crushed between two logs. Some images are still vivid. Ashore in cabins and village shops, lizards were always seen around the wall lamps, apparently quite harmless. The absolute blackness of the jungle when we were anchored at night in any of the rivers. The magnificent thunder and lightning in the hills above Freetown. And my utter terror when I first saw a praying mantis. Having been brought up on a literary diet of Sanders of the River and the Wide World magazine, I was disappointed not to see a district commissioner going upstream in his canoe, and very disappointed at the apparent absence of big wild animals. I expected to see crocodiles plunging off riverbanks at every turn, which didn't happen. At Sapele, I borrowed a dugout canoe and went upstream into the mangrove swamp. The canoe proved remarkably easy to steer by a minor twist of the paddle blade, but I was terrified of the dark, muddy waters. I made a painting of our ship on the lid of a cardboard carton. Captain Pugh was delighted to accept it when we were finally paid off at Liverpool on the 8th of November 1950, after our voyage of 3 months, 8 days. I had been to the Guinea coast of West Africa, the so-called white man's grave, where I could have caught malaria or died of yellow fever, and had come home safely.
Captain Brendan Ford.